No, it's almost it's almost more than the heart can bear to hear that story. When you hear both the majesty and the tragedy and all the different elements and so perfectly expressed through the music as well as the Bible verses. When we were last Sunday, on Palm Sunday, sort of giving the story in sequence, we got to the point where Jesus had come in with all his disciples into the city of Jerusalem. That was the Palm Sunday. The song, Who Dreamed of the Tragedy, is written for that day because there's such an anticipation of final fulfillment in that triumphant entry, and very few could anticipate how that was going to actually play out. And for us as devotees, all these years later, the most beneficial way to live through this story is to stand in the shoes of those who were loyal to Christ. I was going to say those who understood him, but it's not really clear how many understood him at that point. Perhaps John, perhaps his mother, maybe Mary Magdalene. But a lot of the clarity that the disciples acquired came after he left, after he died, after he was resurrected, and then all of the inspiration that they were able to receive after that was done. In fact, at the Last Supper, which I'll talk about in a moment, he said to them many times, I'm leaving because it's the only way to take you all, you know, into your next level of understanding. They had to, it wasn't only that Jesus had to physically go away, because his consciousness was not limited by his physical body. It wasn't like he had to be out of that body in order to be able to give them infinite awareness. They were capable of having it. There were two realities he had to carry out. One was actually the sacrifice of his body. In the sense, in the yogic sense that Yogananda describes, whereby sacrificing that body, yeah, I mean, the way the church teaches it is not entirely wrong. He really did die to expiate their sins, in the sense that he drew into his physical body a great deal of the karma that was the karma of his disciples. It's like in earlier incarnations, before we are profoundly enlightened, we set in motion certain energies. And then as we learn our lessons and align ourselves with the spiritual master, we may have advanced to the point where we don't really need to have that karma come to us, but it's already been set in motion. And what the guru does literally is he steps between us and that karma, and he takes it on himself. And the masters tell us that the energy has to go somewhere, and when the master has a physical body, it will go into his physical body. And so when Jesus died on the cross, in the way that he died, he literally burned up a lot of karma for his disciples. And then those disciples were able to advance spiritually because a certain karmic burden had been lifted from them. I know all of us have had moments where you feel like something has been lifted from you, and then you can go forward, whatever the cause of that. So that was part of it. The other part of it was the disciples themselves, those who had the courage to walk behind the master through this experience, and even if they wavered for a time, but to hold on to their inner perception of his divine reality despite everything that happened, the great power and certainty that they gained from having to face something so difficult also elevated them, you know, lifted them. And the day of Pentecost, which came later, where they were all lifted up in the Spirit, was a direct result of the experience they'd been through. Now, it's very hard in our modern times to quite understand, sort of how head-to-head the conflict was that Jesus was provoking. There was this enormously powerfully structured temple with all the priests who were really in charge of that temple, and they were in charge of the dogma, and they were in charge of everybody's spiritual fate and future. There was no discussion about it. They were the authorities. They were the scholars. They were the ones who decided all the spiritual questions. They had power, position, influence. And the Jews were an isolated people in a very unsupportive world, including the whole Roman Empire ruling their country. So they had no place to go, no recourse. Plus, the belief system that they were all deeply immersed in led them to believe, for the most part, that these priests and powerful people were the appropriate channel to give them their truth. And this priesthood also had the power not only to persecute, but to excommunicate, to expel from the synagogue, from the community. And if a person was expelled by this priesthood, again, they had no place to go. And in fact, later on, after Jesus died, that is one of the things that happened, which is the followers of Jesus within the Jewish community were gradually completely cast out from the Jewish community, and they lost their livelihood, they lost their ability to survive, and it was only Paul, by this time, who had been created a vast group of Gentile Christians who gathered money from them and came back and saved them. So these Jews, Jewish disciples of Jesus, who were willing to walk behind him while he, time after time during this week and before, was constantly starting these confrontations with these very powerful people. And the crowds were dogmatic for the most part. And Jesus was violating, just openly violating their most precious tenets. The Lord was very distant. You know, a person didn't declare himself to be one with the Father. I am the Son of God. It was a blasphemy that is difficult for us even to understand. You know, for someone to stand up and declare that in the temple, I am the Son of God. You know, I am one with the Father. God is my Father. It was horror to hear it. And the priests would fight against him and incite the mob, and then the mob would get excited. And on several different occasions, people picked up stones. They were going to stone Jesus to death because what he was saying was so wrong and so frightening. I mean, this was Kali Yuga descending. This was a time when dogmatism ruled, when there was no sort of margin for free expression. It was right and it was wrong. And when it was wrong, it was terribly wrong. So these disciples of Jesus, when Jesus decided even to go to Jerusalem for this Passover, he was going to go back to Judea. He was safely outside of their jurisdiction. He'd fled from Jerusalem and that area. He decides to go back. And he's going to go back to see Lazarus, and then he's going to go back. And the disciples say to him, it's like they don't understand what's moving him. And they say, you can't go back there. They've put a price on your head. They've told people that they must report you. They're going to arrest you. And he says, I go. I mean, and he doesn't explain. He doesn't give them a long story. He doesn't tell them all the things that are going to happen. He just says, I go. Because part of what he knew his disciples had to have was their faith in him had to be based entirely on their inner experience. That's why when he says to them, who am I? Earlier, he says, who am I? And then people say, well, some say that you're this prophet or that prophet or this one or that one. And Peter declares, you are the Messiah. You are the Son of God. Now, that was like a huge revelation to declare, because that was the whole question All of the people were waiting for this certain prophet to come, for the predicted Messiah, for the one who was going to liberate them. But everybody thinks they want this person to be a reflection of their own reality. So you have the priest, they expect him to be the most powerful priest. You have the scholars, you expect him to be the smartest scholar. You know, you have the merchant, you expect him to be the shrewdest businessman. And of course, God's ways are not our ways. And the very nature of the prophet when he comes is that he explodes all these little holdings of the mind. And one of the reasons that that priesthood couldn't see Jesus for what he was is that he wasn't one of them. And in fact, far from being one of them, he was standing against all of the positions that they'd built up. And the disciples, by no means did they have the whole picture. They had found this man, or Jesus had found them. They had looked into his eyes. They had heard him preach. They had felt something in him they had never felt before. And who knows, you know, in the privacy of their meditation, what came to them? Who knows, in the intimacy of their relationship with Jesus, what had been revealed to him? But still, they follow him into this, their own home place, their own temple, and the priests that they've come to respect are calling him blasphemous, and the crowds are picking up stones, and they still have to be strong enough in their own faith. Really, as Swami puts it, it's not even so much their faith in Jesus as their faith in their own experience. Because in the madness of the mob, they have nothing to believe but themselves. You see? Especially after he was arrested. So they go through this week in Jerusalem, in and out of the city, in which Jesus is provoking the confrontation more and more. And Judas is beginning to have this thought. And you know, Judas wasn't exactly, it wasn't that he lost faith in Jesus. It was more subtle than that. Because he was a chosen apostle. He was one of the 12. He did have a very advanced consciousness. But he began to, as Swami describes it, he began to set his own perception of what ought to happen against that of what Jesus was doing. And Judas was an educated man, and he had faith in that establishment. And he thought, if we could just get Jesus in front of the Sanhedrin, in front of these priests and scholars, and have Jesus just stand up to them and declare it, then those people will be converted, and then we'll all really be able to make this happen. But he couldn't get Jesus to commit to that. So Judas took it upon himself, in a sense, to sort of back Jesus into a corner. And so he decided he would cooperate with those priests in bringing Jesus to trial. That was his idea. And his idea was that once Jesus was there, that would be the moment in which this power that Judas felt in him would come forth. And he never thought that Jesus would allow himself to be killed. And that is why, among other reasons, that immediately afterwards Judas went and hung himself. Because it just, you know, everything had crumbled. He had been the instrument. He'd been the one who led the Roman cohort, the Jewish guard, you know, to capture his own master. Imagine that reality. So Jesus takes them to the Passover Seder, which is now called the Last Supper, because it was the last time that Jesus sat with his disciples, and it was a Passover Seder. They were celebrating the Passover there. And early on in it, Jesus just begins to talk to them. I'm going to a place where you can't follow me. I'm going to a place where you won't be able to find me. Peter says, Sir, I would follow you even to death. I'd be willing to die for you. Peter was always very dramatic. And you have this extraordinary moment between the two of them, where Jesus turns to him and says, would you? Like that. I always just imagine, you know, just everybody watching. And Jesus, and Peter's been so dramatic. Would you? And Jesus says to him, three times before the dawn comes, you will deny that you ever knew me. Now, on one hand, of course, Peter can't even believe this, because who's anticipating what's going to happen? And on the other hand, imagine. After that happened to him, which had happened exactly as Jesus predicted, imagine how Peter felt within himself to know that the Master knew and didn't withdraw his love from him. And then later, when after Jesus is resurrected, three times Jesus says to Peter, "Do you love me?" And Peter has to answer him three times, "Yes, Lord, I love you." It's as if the karma sort of went one way and then the karma went the other way. The story of Peter is always particularly touching because, well, let me go a little bit through the Last Supper, then I'll come there. But Jesus is here in this evening, and Judas is also present. And Jesus tells them, you know, "You are my chosen, and all of you are clean, except the one who is chosen not to be." And that's Judas. And they all look so shocked. And Jesus says, "Before this night is over, one of you will betray me." And again, he's speaking to his disciples, saying, "I know who you are. You think you can fool me, but I know who you are." And so the other disciples, the way the Bible tells it, they say, you know, they signal to John, the writer of the Gospel of John, who had this most intimate relationship with Jesus, somehow he could ask. So John leans over and he says, "Who is it? Who is the one?" And Jesus says, "The one to whom I give this bread," or "the one who dips the bread in the bowl after me." So Jesus does this, then Judas does this. And then Jesus looks at him and says, "That which you are about to do, do quickly." So Jesus rises up and leaves the room, and then he goes off and he begins the process that ends in Jesus' arrest. But once Judas has left the room, you see, once that dissonance is gone, then Jesus really begins to teach. He really begins to teach. And this is the time also when he washes the feet of his own disciples. And they have revered him all this time, you know, as the Messiah himself, and suddenly he's kneeling at their feet with his own hands and washing their feet like this. And once again, Peter always plays the role. When Jesus comes to him to wash his feet, Peter says, "Lord, I can't allow you to do this. I just can't allow it. How can you touch my feet like this?" And Jesus says, "If you do not allow this, you are not my disciple." There's a story that Master tells about just a young girl, and gave her a certain rose for a ceremony, and it was a color she didn't want. She says, "I want the yellow one." And Master looked at her and he said, "What I give, you take," like that. So Jesus looks at Peter and says, "You take what I give or you are not my disciple." And then Peter, with his characteristic enthusiasm, says, "Well, Lord, then not just my feet, but my head, my hands, you know, all the way." And then Jesus teaches, and he tells them in retrospect everything that's going to happen. "I'm going away. You will not see me for a while. I'm going to a place where you can't follow me." I realize I never finished that story about Peter, but when Peter said to Jesus that you are the Christ, the Son of God, and he said, "No man has told you this, but you know it from your own self." And you see, that's what spiritual life has to be. And that's why the story is so important. And that's why the challenge that the disciples felt is so important. When everything that you expect is different than you expect, what can you rely on? What do we have within us? What do we really know is true without anyone having to support us? But we just know because it is our nature to know. So Jesus teaches his disciples, and he tells them, "I'm going away, but you will see me again. You will mourn, you will be sad. The world will rejoice, but you will be sad." And then he tells them also, he tells them everything. "The world will reject you, the world will hate you, because I have chosen you." I mean, they're sitting here, they don't know what's about to happen. They've come into Jerusalem, and Here Jesus is just planting all this into them. And then just hours later, the whole drama unfolds. So they leave the house where they've had the Last Supper and they go out to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Judas knows where they are because they often go to this place. So Judas is now collecting the armed force that he's going to bring to this place, and they're going to find this man. And Jesus knows that this hour is coming. And he's with his disciples and he asks them to pray with him. Stay awake and pray with me. And they all can't quite stay awake. The spirit is willing, Jesus says, but the flesh is weak. You know. But in the end, you know, all is forgiven. Then comes to the story that we started talking about here, where they're alone with the master, where they've been many times, but suddenly the marching soldiers come. I mean, just picture it. All of a sudden, this armed force is coming, this clanging, dissonant, frightening force is coming. And there's just a few disciples there, and they come forward, and then Jesus goes out to meet them. You know, the tendency when a test comes is to cower back. And maybe it's going to happen, but maybe if I make myself small enough and maybe if I hide enough, it'll pass me over. And Jesus instead walks forward. He just shows us this is how it's done. Who are you looking for? He says. They say, Jesus of Nazareth. And then he says, I am he. And then he takes another step forward. And there's that wonderful moment because of the force of him stepping forward, they all fall down backwards. He hasn't laid a hand on them. But just the power of that. But the disciples are like this behind him. But Peter picks up a sword, his own sword, and he attacks like this. I mean, what courage. You know, what determination, what dedication. But Jesus stops him. And then some of the accounts say that he picks up the ear that Peter has cut off and puts it back on. You know, he does a little miracle healing on the spot. But he says to Peter, that's not what we're going to do here. As Jesus later says to Pilate, if my kingdom were of this world, my men, as he calls them, I love that phrase, my men would have fought for me. You know, there's that loyalty like that. But he wouldn't let them. And then the disciples scatter. And only a few of them are even able to follow. He's being arrested. They don't know if they're going to be arrested. They don't know what's going to happen. And they scatter and only a few follow. And then all the rest happens. You know, that's so difficult. And Peter, even Peter, with all his courage, standing there, three times they say, but haven't I seen you with him? Weren't you one of his disciples? Weren't you there in the garden when he was arrested? And each time Peter says, no, not me, no. And then he hears the sound of that rooster crowing. And it's like he comes out of it, and all of a sudden he weeps and runs away. And then the way this story ends, we know it's not the end of the story, is that Jesus is simply taken and he dies. You know, and he dies with such nobility, you know, such courage in the face of it all. He says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And Master writes later in his beautiful tribute to Christ, he said, what a miracle of forgiveness was created when you uttered those, you know, inexpressibly beautiful words. And that is then becomes, even before Jesus is resurrected, that becomes the pinnacle of the example of his life. You know, we're so eager to speak of how we were mistreated and how we were misunderstood and all the hard things that happened to us. And then here, you know, this man personifying the relationship with God that all of us would have is just fearfully mistreated. And all he says is, forgive them. He prays to intercede with the Heavenly Father for their karma. Not only is there nothing in his heart that protects himself, but he actually asks God not to give them what they deserve, But to allow that karma, really Jesus is saying, to be taken upon himself. They know not what they do. Then he says, he takes care of his mother. He looks and he sees his mother and he sees the disciple John, and he knows he's leaving. He says to John, behold, she is now your mother. And he says to his mother, because I'm leaving you, behold, you're losing me as a son, but he is your son. And then the Bible says, and from that day, John took her into his house and took care of her. And just like the human, the divine, the infinite, the infinitesimal, all just gathered into this extraordinary moment. And then those few disciples, his mother, Mary Magdalene, John, and a few others, just standing there and watching him die. You know, 2 days later, of course, he rises. But in that moment, he dies. So what happens to the heart, you know, when everything turns in a way that we don't expect it to turn? Do we then just take ourselves away from the light? Or can we stand with the faith of our own inner experience, even in that moment, and still believe? In the Festival of Light, it says, after a while, night fell, and the little bird says, how can I fly in this darkness? I mean, can you imagine the darkness of watching Jesus be crucified and then die? How can I fly in this darkness? And the night whispers, peace awaits you in the unknown. Isn't that glorious? And now later, when Jesus is resurrected, the disciples have all come back together. And Swamiji makes a really strong point about what an absolute act of faith that was. You see, if they had lost faith, they would not have come back together. I mean, imagine here if some great tragedy happened to us as a church and we were attacked in some way and we all were driven out of this room. You know, if we still believed in what we were doing, we would come back, wouldn't we? And that would be the sign. That would be the sign to God, really, that despite the fact that we were challenged, we still came back together. And so it was then that the disciples were gathered together. The door was locked because they were afraid, but they had come back together. Even though the darkness had descended and they didn't know where they were going, they had surrendered to that reality. And then Jesus appears in the midst of them. And what does he say? Peace be unto you. Isn't that beautiful? Well, we'll stay there for tonight.